earthquakes, but there's nothing I can do. A quake's an act of nature, that's just a simple fact. I can't be sued, so you are screwed if you've been fracked. To get the gas out of the shale, I shoot some water down. It's full of deadly chemicals that go deep underground. It mixes with more toxins and then comes flooding back. But that's okay with the EPA, so you've been fracked. I'll poison all your water, contaminate your land. I'll make you sign a contract you don't really understand. I'll dig a well straight down hell and turn your water black. And when I'm done, I'll cut and run, cause you've been fracked. You say your family's owned this land since 1822. But now you need the money and there's nothing else to do. Grandfather's left. Just sign below and soon you'll know that you've been fracked. You say that you've been feeling bad since I began to drill. You say your cattle all are dead and all your kids are ill. Your land's not worth a penny, you wish you hadn't cracked. Well, ain't that nice, but don't think twice, cause you've been fracked. I'll poison all your water, contaminate your land. I'll make you sign a contract you don't really understand. I'll dig a well straight down hell and turn your water black. And when I'm done, I'll cut and run, cause you've been fracked.
That was New York Youth Against Fracking and their song You've Been Fracked, opening this edition of Climate Radio. Last month, the average concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere reached 400 parts per million. And it's rising at what the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association describes as an unprecedented clip. Here's Dr. Pieter Tans making the announcement.
And on the 9th of May, yesterday, we measured CO2 at Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii to go over 400 ppm, which is a milestone, you could say. We think this is a significant milestone. It reminds us of the fact that CO2 in the atmosphere currently is higher than it has been in the last at least 2 million years. What is also significant is that the rate of increase is rapid. The current rate of increase, as measured on average over the last decade, has been 2 ppm per year. This is at least 100 times higher than any time in the last 800,000 years. As has been measured in ice cores. So this is truly very, very different from what the Earth has experienced over the last millions of years.
So how did the UK government respond to this reminder of the rate at which we are currently hurtling towards environmental disaster? Did the Prime Minister say, enough is enough, there will be no more revolving door between the oil and gas companies and members of my cabinet? It's time to put the public interest ahead of private gain and corporate profit. Did it cancel its support for Arctic drilling, Canadian tar sands and biofuels, recognising that there's no carbon budget left for these extreme energy sources if we are to maintain a habitable planet? Unfortunately not. What Prime Minister David Cameron and Liberal Democrat Party leader Nick Clegg actually did was to whip their MPs into voting against a clean power future and for Chancellor George Osborne's plan to build up to 40 new gas-fired electricity generating stations. Osborne's grand plan envisages some of that gas being produced in the UK by the controversial process of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. All that happened last week, the same week in which 21 climate protesters were charged with community service sentences for occupying and shutting down one of these gas-fired power stations in order to stop this apparently senseless dash for gas. Senseless is certainly the view of the Climate Change Committee, the body established by the UK's Climate Change Act to give the government independent expert advice on how to meet its carbon budgets. The government have been ignoring the committee's strong and consistent advice that we should be decarbonising our energy supply. So I spoke to their CEO, David Kennedy, and asked him why the committee thought it was so important that we had a virtually carbon-free electricity network by 2030.
electricity sector is at the heart of moving to a low-carbon economy, and there's three reasons. One, it's a major source of emissions, so it accounts for about 25% of emissions in the UK economy. Two is because we have a set of technologies that are available or we expect to be available in the future with which we can decarbonize the power sector at relatively low cost, and those technologies are renewable power generation, it's nuclear power generation, and it's carbon capture and storage applied to fossil fuels. The third thing is that once we've got a clean power sector, we can extend that to other sectors, and in particular to surface transport through electric vehicles and to heat in buildings through modern efficient heat pumps. And so the power sector is key to decarbonizing those other two key sources of current emissions.
Can you explain why you think it would be economically sensible for the UK to take its electricity sector carbon-free?
Well, we've got a target in primary legislation, that's the Climate Change Act, to reduce our economy-wide emissions by 80% in 2050. And at the heart of that has to be moving to a low-carbon power sector. Now, our analysis has compared two alternatives. You either move early to a low-carbon power sector, or you delay and then you try and invest very quickly and build a new electricity system. It is clearly cheaper to move early, to invest early in a low-carbon power system.
The Climate Change Act also requires you to consider the impact of energy policy on fuel poverty. So what are the relative impacts on fuel bills of taking the low-carbon route over the taking the gas route?
Well, there's two things to distinguish here. There are general impacts on energy bills, so for the typical household, and investment in low-carbon technologies, it will put electricity prices up. It will add around £100 to the typical household bill by 2020, beyond which bills will stay broadly constant. And if you compare that to the alternative of investing in gas-fired generation, well, that will be cheaper over the next few years, but it will become increasingly expensive over time. And the cost saving for households collectively of being on that early decarbonisation path is about £100 billion over the next decade. So you pay a bit more over the next 10 years, that buys you a benefit. It's like an insurance policy that limits your exposure to very high prices in the future. Now, that's for the typical household. Now, fuel poverty is slightly different. So bills for the fuel poor will go up, again, by about £100 for the typical household. But there is a policy in place that targets energy efficiency improvement on those fuel-poor households. And those two things together should broadly, over time, cancel out. Okay. So while there will be affordability impacts for the general population over the next years, if we're successful with our energy efficiency policies, then we shouldn't see a detrimental impact on fuel poverty. There will still be people in fuel poverty, as there are now. That won't be because of the carbon policies.
So, I mean, there's been some debate in the popular press about what's been responsible for, you know, we've already seen a rise in the cost of fuel bills over the last 10 years. But you did some analysis on this that you published, I think, at the end of last year. How much of the rise in energy bills that we've seen recently is down to the rising cost of gas, and how much of it is down to measures, government measures that are about reducing our greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, energy bills for households have gone up very significantly over the last 5 years by about £400. So they were 5 years ago £800 for the typical household, and they are now £1,200. And almost all of that £400 increase is due to a change in the price of gas in the international markets, which feeds through to our heating bills. But it also increases the price of electricity, given that at the moment we have mainly gas-fired power generation.
Is there any scenario that you looked at in which going for gas in the way that George Osborne is currently intending is going to mean cheaper fuel bills for us in the UK?
We should be clear. There's a lot of exaggeration about the potential impact of shale gas in this country, and people look at America and they say, well, shale gas has caused the gas price to drop very significantly over there, and that's true. Nobody is thinking that is actually going to happen here in this country, so We have got some shale gas reserves. We may be successful bringing them to market, and probably they will not have a great impact on the price, which is likely to stay at broadly the levels it is now. Actually, we have looked, just for doing rigorous analysis, at a scenario where there is a very low gas price. It isn't what we're predicting. But even if there is a low gas price, there isn't a saving in having a gas-based power system over the next decade, unless we give up on efforts to tackle climate change, and then gas may well be cheaper. But we are committed to make our contribution to tackling climate change. As long as that's the case, then gas-fired power generation is not cheaper.
Can I ask you about the impact, if we continue on with the dash for gas, on our national carbon budgets? Would we still be able to meet those if we go down the gas route?
Well, there is a sensible way to meet our carbon budgets, and that's through investing in low carbon technologies. There is a legal question about if we were to instead invest in gas-fired power generation and then buy offsets for that in the carbon market, would that be an appropriate way to meet the carbon budgets? I hope it doesn't come to that. It will be a silly thing to do. It will be storing up costs and risks for the future. So we should try to make sure that we're investing in low carbon technologies. It's important to say as well, the government is fully committed to invest in low carbon technologies over the next 10 years. And the question is, what do we do once we hit 2020? And it will be silly, having invested in low carbon technologies for 10 years, to suddenly stop and switch over to gas and then switch back 10 years later to investment in low carbon technologies. That is what needs to be resolved now. It's about, can the government make a commitment for the 2020s that continues what they are already committed to?
So basically we get a danger of some lock-in if we build new gas-fired power stations now. You can't decommission.
Well,
they're around for about 25 years or something.
I mean, it's more what you want from an investment perspective. You can't have a stop-start approach. You can't just turn investment on and then turn it off at will. I mean, what you need is a direction of travel that you give to investors, and then you organise around that. You develop projects, you have factories that can produce wind turbines and other parts of the supply chain that organise around a direction of travel. You can't switch what you're doing halfway along the path. You can't give investors a load of uncertainty and expect them still to make the investments that we need as a country. So that is why we need to resolve uncertainties and make commitments that are sensible over the next two decades, and then we can see then the investments and the economic benefits and the jobs associated with those investments coming forward.
Currently, the government does seem to be changing course from a commitment to a low-carbon future to one that is more based on gas. What impact is that having on clean energy investment in the UK right now?
I wouldn't say the government is not committed. So we have carbon budgets that are ambitious, that were legislated by this government. And we've got funding in place that is very significant to cover investments over the next 10 years. That rises to about £7.5 billion funding for investments in low-carbon power generation by 2020. So there is commitment in that sense. There are mixed messages coming from the government. There is talk about shale gas and a dash for gas. And what that's doing is creating uncertainty. So on the one hand, the government's committed. On the other, it is raising questions, and faced with that situation, investors are likely not to put the money into this country that we want them to put in. And the way around that is to resolve the uncertainties, to make commitments, to rule out a dash for gas, which would be a silly thing to do. It would be expensive for consumers, and then we would expect the investments to come forward.
That was David Kennedy, CEO of the Committee on Climate Change, saying that a dash for gas would be an expensive way of meeting our climate commitments. In pursuing the dash for gas, it seems Chancellor George Osborne has bought into the fossil fuel company's narrative that tapping into our shale gas resource using the controversial process of fracking will bring us a new national source of prosperity. In doing so, he is ignoring the fact that the UK has the largest offshore wind resource in Europe, and as the 2010 offshore valuation produced in association with the government showed, that harnessing just 29% of this resource by 2050 would turn the UK into a net exporter of electricity and create 145,000 new jobs. I spoke to Dr. John Broderick of the UK's leading climate policy research network, the Tyndall Centre, about the prospect of developing shale gas in the UK. Would it be compatible with meeting our international climate change commitments?
The question there is what are the climate commitments at the start that you'd be wanting to stick to? And that's internationally being taken to be 2 degrees increase in global mean temperature. And that's kind of taken as a guardrail between dangerous and acceptable. Now, obviously, that's a political decision as to where that lies. You know, there'll be climate impacts below that, and how the impacts are borne is not even around the world. Different people, different places, different ecosystems will suffer different amounts of change. But in any case, if you take that 2 degrees as the guardrail, that you would want to kind of work back to the amount of CO2 that would give you a good chance of staying away from it. And so when at the Tyndall Centre we've gone through the emissions budget, the amount of CO2 that we would fairly allocate to the UK is a very small budget, and one that suggests we would have to go for a decarbonised energy system, not just an electricity network that's got no CO2 coming out of it, but our heating and transport as well. And that would have to come into play by 2030. And so the question mark around shale gas and its compatibility is all about the timescale. Whether you can have a transition that is so short-lived, and we're very kind of wary of that. There just doesn't seem to be space over that period of time to add another high-carbon fossil fuel into the mix. There's been lots of discussion about the relative carbon intensity of shale gas versus natural gas versus coal. I mean, at the bottom line is that they're all fossil fuels. You know, natural gas is 3/4 carbon, you know, the methane molecules. And so it's not a transition to a very low or a zero carbon energy source, and therefore there's just very little space available in the emissions budget over the relevant time periods.
Right. I mean, looking, for example, at the Ed Davies speech on the launch of the Office of Unconventional Gas and Oil, he said that these resources could be developed while protecting the planet for future generations. I mean, it doesn't seem like he's listened to what you're saying.
No, I've yet to see the detail of how he proposes that would be the case.
Okay, looking globally, what would be the potential impact on global emissions from shale gas? George Osborne's talking about building maybe up to 40 gas-fired electricity stations over the next few years, but they have an average life of about 25 years, so they could be around to 2040. How would that play into the decarbonisation by 2030 scenario that you say we need to avoid 2 degrees C?
Yeah, if we're going to stick to this 2 degrees Celsius, then we would be having to retire those facilities before the end of their lives. I mean, or they create a substantial incentive not to stick to our climate commitments. And this is a commitment to the amount of warming that we would have in the atmosphere, not commitments under the present budgets that the UK has agreed to, the UK government has agreed to. We have concerns here about whether or not shale gas is an additional source of fossil fuels or a substitute source of fossil fuels. There's been lots of talk about gas replacing coal, and there may be emissions benefits if that's the case. I mean, you still have to understand how the energy system, the global energy system, is going to change, but there's still possibility of gas being burned if it replaced coal. But we did some work looking at the US energy system, and that suggests that the US continued to produce coal and export coal at the same time as it was increasing the amount of gas that it was burning in its power stations, and that those emissions of coal are in addition to the emissions from the shale gas being produced. We reckon that about half to 60% of the emissions benefits are just exported overseas. And so that was a kind of very preliminary piece of work, and it's something that we think a lot more attention needs to be paid. So looking to the global effect of the availability of new fossil fuels.
That was Dr. John Broderick of the Tyndall Centre. and that's the climate change framework for the fracking industry. Unless we have a global cap on emissions or a carbon tax, shale gas will just add to the amount of fossil fuel that is already available to be burned. And we know that if we are to have a chance of maintaining a habitable planet, at least 80% of already known fossil fuel reserves need to stay in the ground. With this in mind, it was disturbing to discover that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office has been promoting fracking around the globe through the UK Trade and Industry Department. Just like we saw when we looked at Arctic drilling, away from the public's glare, the Foreign Office seems to be promoting the interest of fossil fuel companies over the public interest. Perhaps it's time we had a public debate about the role the Foreign and Commonwealth Office plays in climate change policy. Perhaps also it's time we had a debate about Peter Lilly MP. Remember him from Margaret Thatcher's government when he led their attack on welfare? Now, Lilly is a climate sceptic who is campaigning to repeal the UK's world-leading Climate Change Act. Worryingly, his influence within government is on the rise, and since April, he sits on the Conservative Party's new policy board. Lilly continues to receive money for his work for oil company Tethys Petroleum, while sitting on the influential Energy and Climate Change Committee, who recently wrote a report urging the government to start fracking in the UK. Here he is on BBC Radio 4 just a few days ago, playing down the risks of fracking.
This is a technology which has been in use since 1948. Over recent years, more than 100,000 fracking wells have been drilled in the United States. Not a single person has been harmed by water contamination, which is one of the alleged risks. Not a single building or structure has been damaged by earth tremors, which is the other of the alleged risks. This is a tried and tested technology.
Not a single person has been harmed, says Lilly. Would he say that under oath? He's certainly correct when he says fracking is a tried and tested technology, but the results are in, and they're not looking good. The Oscar-nominated film Gasland gathered together the testimonies of numerous people across the US suffering health impacts due to air and water pollution caused by fracking. If you haven't seen the film, you must. Here's a taster.
And then finally, I got a chance to sit down with Theo Kohlborn, winner of 5 Rachel Carson Awards, a Time Magazine Environmentalist of the Year, and Congressional Fellow. Her accolades are too numerous to count.
We've begun to look at what's being used to drill a well, data that the government should be collecting but isn't collecting. We've been able to get our hands on some of that.
Because of the exemptions, fracking chemicals are considered proprietary, like the special sauce for a Big Mac or the secret formula for Coca-Cola. The only reason we know anything about the fracking chemicals is because of the work of Theo Kohlborn. By chasing down trucks, combing through material safety data sheets, and collecting samples, Theo has identified 596 different chemicals in 900 chemical products.
Every environmental law we wrote to protect public health is ignored. But the neurological effects are very insidious.
3 years ago, I started getting really dizzy.
At first, you may just have headaches. Then the next thing, you might have ringing in your ears.
I thought I had an inner ear infection. I went to my doctor, and she's kind of, your ears are clean.
Or you may be a little disoriented, or you may feel a little dizzy.
So they sent me down for a CAT scan.
But eventually, you may feel what is called peripheral neuropathy. And when you get to this stage, you have irreversible brain damage.
For the last 4 years, I have these lesions in my brain. Don't know where they came from.
You may begin to get swelling.
I hurt everywhere in my body, my legs, my feet, everywhere.
Your extremities, especially the arms and the legs.
I couldn't move. I couldn't reach my face to eat.
And never know where the pain is going to be. The pain can be excruciating. Think about the workers or the people whose yards or backyards or within 1,000 feet of their home have a well pad.
They can't get away from the tanks and the fumes are all the time.
They're inhaling these chemicals 24/7 around the clock.
What's that just smell?
I don't know. I can't smell anything.
And you lost your sense of smell, and so did he.
That is one of the side effects of hydrogen sulfide exposure. I don't smell the cat box.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. For 2 years now, I haven't smelled flowers.
Taste, I can't taste hardly nothing.
I can taste salty, and I can taste sweet.
Salty? I can taste it. Sweet, I can taste it.
But I don't get any of the subtleties or aromas of food. It's like all texture for me now. Yeah, it's not good.
The only reason fracking went ahead in the US was because Dick Cheney secured an exemption for the industry, known as the Halliburton loophole, from environmental legislation such as the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. And the oil and gas companies have been aggressively silencing affected communities by buying their silence. On June the 6th, Bloomberg Businessweek of a review of hundreds of regulatory and legal filings and found that in most of the cases, homeowners had been bound to silence. This is consistent with the allegation of Environmental Protection Agency whistleblower Weston Wilson in Gasland, who said,
"One could characterize this entire industry as having 100 years of history of purchasing those they contaminate. So they purchase the land, and often with an agreement of secrecy of somebody that's alleging they've been contaminated by oil and gas production."
There is widespread and growing opposition to hydraulic fracturing by communities in the US and around the world. Even Yoko Ono has gotten on board and has started a campaign called Artists Against Fracking. They too have a song.
Don't frack my mother, 'cause I ain't got no other. Don't frack my mother, you can do anything that you wanna do, but don't frack my mother.
Don't frack me! Don't frack me!
Climate Radio spoke to Australia's own Theo Colborne, the senior advisor to the National Toxics Network, Dr. Marianne Lloyd-Smith, about the impacts that fracking was having on communities in Australia. There are a number of problems associated with gas fracking, but I just wonder if we can zoom in on the water pollution. Can you explain the process by which fracking results in water pollution?
There are a number of mechanisms that allow contaminants used in hydraulic fracturing and in drilling to contaminate both groundwater and surface water. First, the process of hydraulic fracturing involves putting large amounts of water mixed with chemicals and other things into the ground at high pressure to fracture the seam, either shale or coal seam gas. When you do that, that creates tiny, tiny fractures in the soil, and you may have water seeping from one area or one aquifer into another, and you'll get mixing of those aquifers. Now, that's quite well known. The industry acknowledged that, no question about it. You also then have what's called flowback of the water that you put in with the chemicals. Some of it, sometimes 40, sometimes 50%, sometimes less, comes back to the surface. It comes back carrying all the contaminants that are put into the soil, but also carrying other ones, natural contaminants like BTEX, which is benzene, toluene, a nasty bunch of chemicals. Volatile organic compounds, again, some are carcinogens, some cause neurotoxicity, difficulties with, you know, brain function. So then you're stuck with all of this returned, produced, contaminated water. What do you do with it? You can either, I don't know, you can cart it off to a water treatment plant who can't get rid of all the contaminants. So eventually that water has to go somewhere. It may go into a river. In some cases, like in Scotland, it's put direct into the Sound.
And the industry will claim that the percentage of toxins in the fluids are small. How do you respond to that?
Well, yes, the industry claim that the water that goes down is with the chemicals, and the chemicals are so diluted that it doesn't matter. But when you actually look at the figures, the real figures from the industry's own document, 2% of the fluid that goes down is chemical additive. And that actually translates into anywhere from 16 to 18 tons of chemical additive per frack per well. And if you can imagine all of that going down repeatedly, because a well can be fracked up to 10 times, you have considerable amounts of chemicals going into the ground, which can then mix into the aquifer and move along into other aquifers.
You mentioned in your talk about in the UK, the wastewater would be sent to a waste management facility. Is that a solution?
Well, yes, the government here, the MPs here have told us that you won't be storing water in ponds, that it will be trucked by what I would suggest would be many hundreds and thousands of trucks to a wastewater treatment plant. But the reality about that is that we know there is no technology that can completely clean this water. So the most common technology we use in Australia, called reverse osmosis, just simply won't get out many of the chemicals that the industry use. So even after the water's treated, you've then got semi-contaminated water, which has to go somewhere. And, you know, unfortunately, the most common place it goes is back into rivers and back into the ocean.
We see in Gasland, for example, a range of health impacts. The industry presumably will claim this is anecdotal, but have there been studies done that have been able to document and the health impacts on local communities in the US and Australia?
Well, certainly in Australia, the Queensland government was forced to investigate one cluster of symptoms in a group of, I think, 38 families where there were many children. And they looked at the symptoms, they looked at their exposure, and they had to say finally that some of the symptoms that the residents were experiencing were the result, or were most likely to be the result, of the contaminants from the coal seam gas industry. So that's a government study. The doctor that was treating those residents was very worried about the fact that she didn't think the government had gone far enough in its study, so she undertook her own health study, which has now been published. And sure enough, there is a clear link between their exposure and their position in the gas fields. It's very hard to say which of the contaminants that we have found in air and water would have caused this, and it's much more likely that a mixture of contaminants related to the industry are having impacts on human health. But this is a situation we've seen in other places like Pennsylvania, Canada, and I think what we will see over the coming months is a number of studies and reviews of health impacts of this industry, because it certainly does have health impacts.
Okay. The EPA in the United States, for example, was basically... The allegation from the whistleblower in Gasland is that they've been told to look the other way and aren't monitoring the impacts of this industry at all.
The problem about monitoring is that most EPAs across the globe, and again I'll speak from my Australian experience, most environment departments are being having their funding reduced, their personnel reduced. Even if they wanted to go out there and monitor this industry, they would neither have the personnel, the resources, or even the expertise. The industry in many places is growing at such a rapid rate that it just is outstripping the ability of environmental agencies to do stuff. And of course, you know, many governments are very pro this industry because they like the sound of the money and the supposed jobs, and so they put pressure on regulators to perhaps hurry up an acceptance or a license. And so, you know, what we see is permits being given without adequate scrutiny of all of the effects. But I would certainly suggest that even with good scrutiny, with good monitoring, this is not an industry that you can make safe. This is not an industry that you can somehow regulate into a no-risk situation. It is a destructive and risky industry by nature.
Okay, that was going to be my next question, because in this country we have the Royal Society and the Royal Academy of Engineering, which have produced this report.
The Geological Society's report.
Which they say the health, safety and environmental risks can be managed effectively in the UK. Operational best practices must be implemented and enforced through strong regulation.
Yes, I definitely had a look at that report. It's strange because when you read the body of it, the body of the report doesn't really back up the conclusions, which I found a little strange when I was reading it. And I think it is a very optimistic view of the industry. Certainly based on real world experience, both in Australia, Canada, the United States, it does not appear that you can regulate this industry into safety. And since I've been here in the UK, I've had members of parliament tell me that the problems we're seeing in Australia could never happen in England because, you know, there's better regulations in the UK. But, you know, my response to that is one of the companies that is working here and trying to develop the industry in both UK and Scotland has left Australia because our regulations are so strict. So, you know, the argument that somehow you can do it better than we can just doesn't hold water.
Okay, one other claim in the conclusions of that report, which you might be able to deal with, was they say the risk of fractures propagating to reach overlying aquifers is very low, provided that shale gas extraction takes place at depths of many hundreds of metres or several kilometres. Is that correct in your understanding?
The idea that shale happens at a much lower, much deeper depth than, say, coal seam gas is quite true. On average, it is lower. But when we've looked at some of the geological structures here in the UK, it appears that some of the seams are well within a distance where a fracture, which can go anything up to 600 metres and, you know, maybe longer, could actually reach overlying aquifers. And the thing is, that is the experience that has occurred in the United States. Again, this isn't hypothetical. It has happened. And then if you look at coal seam gas, which is different to shale, certainly in Australia, our experience is we are seeing chemicals, natural chemicals like BTEX, benzene, toluene, coming through and appearing in monitoring wells. So it's nice to talk about hypotheticals, but it's also important to look at what is actually happening in the real world.
Okay. Can I ask you about some of the health impacts that we've actually seen? Presumably this has been documented in Australia as well as in the US. Yeah.
The sort of cluster of symptoms we're seeing in Australia, everything from eye and skin irritations, and when I say skin irritations, it sounds minimal, but these are very, very bad rashes and irritations which are quite debilitating. We're seeing children having lack of concentration, strange colouring around their mouth and their nose, excessive bleeding from the nose, severe headaches that go on for a long time. But probably one of the most worrying group of symptoms is a thing called paresthesia, which is like tingling or numbness or strange effects in your fingers and toes. And a lot of the children are describing this quite regularly in this particular community that we're dealing with. And we're particularly concerned about that because they're neurotoxic symptoms. And when you look at what the children are being exposed to in air around those communities, it is very consistent with the symptoms they are showing. So, you know, then, of course, there's other things like nausea and tiredness and aching muscles, which are a little bit more nonspecific, but they still have a former cluster of type of symptom we're seeing in Pennsylvania, we're seeing in other places in the United States, and we're certainly seeing in Australia.
How would you say the oil and gas companies have treated local residents in Australia? We, again, in Gasland, we see companies trying to buy people's silence. People that have been suffering health effects or have had their water polluted, are we seeing the companies trying to get those individuals to sign confidentiality agreements?
I think the companies love confidentiality agreements, and certainly where we saw an incident with bad air pollution from farmers who could smell noxious odours and were having respiratory problems, you know, the particular company offered them an air conditioner confidentiality agreement, and they basically told them in good Australian style what you could do with both of them.
What has the psychological impact been on communities in Australia?
I think many of the communities feel under siege. Certainly some of the rural towns in Queensland, it has been tragic because what has happened where there are huge gas fields, where there's a lot of what we call fly-in, fly-out workers who come in, they work for 5-10 days and then they leave, means that they don't join the football club, they don't join the Girl Guides or help out with that sort of thing. So the structure of communities has literally been sort of ripped apart. The other problem is when you have a large number of workers coming in, they want accommodation. So rental prices have literally, you know, spiraled. So, you know, the locals find it very, very difficult to get a house, get somewhere to live. And so many of the locals are simply leaving town. And with that, you have even more of an impact on the communities. So, and then, of course, there's that sense for those that stay, they are being overwhelmed by the new numbers, so they don't like to speak out. And yes, it's a very, very sad state of affairs.
It was interesting that you said Dart Energy was giving up on Australia and coming to the UK. Is that an indication of how perhaps communities are fighting back?
Oh, it certainly is. We've had three companies leave, certainly my region. Two have left New South Wales altogether, which is our main state. Dart has left Australia altogether. All have claimed that the new regulations, the 2 kilometre exclusion zone, which we now have in New South Wales, which basically means you can't drill or fracture within 2 kilometres of a residential area, an agricultural infrastructure like vineyards or horse breeding areas, that has impacted on these companies. And the reason we have those restrictions is the community pressure has been massive. So it's a combination of both that and the fact that when the companies have tried to come in and drill, even if it is outside those 2 kilometres, people have blockaded. They have gone out there. The knitting nanas are out there sitting across the roads, blockading young people, family people, just basically saying, you don't have a social licence for this region and we're not going to let you in. And really, wherever there has been massive community resistance, the companies have not come. So it's a good tale for people here in the UK. If you want to stop these companies, get together with your neighbours, get together with your families and your villages and your towns, and just say no.
That was Marianne Lloyd-Smith, Senior Advisor to the National Toxics Network in Australia, talking to Climate Radio on her recent tour of the UK. Finally, I spoke to Vanessa Vine, Coordinator of Frack Free Sussex and Britain and Ireland Frack Free. She lives a short distance away from the site of a test drill that the UK's leading fracking company, Quadrilla, chaired by former BP CEO Lord Brown, is about to undertake without the consent of the community any day now.
So, yeah, just be nice to know a little bit about the village of Balcombe. How would you describe the village?
Balcombe is a small rural village in the middle of Sussex. It is an area of outstanding natural beauty. It has a tea room and a shop, and a hairdresser's, I think, and a village hall. It's a very conservative little village in Sussex.
Can I ask you why you personally are opposed to fracking in Balcombe?
I live 4 miles from Balcombe. I don't live right in the village. I live 4 miles away as the water flows and as the air moves. The bore that Quadrilla have leased or bought is 100 yards from the main London to Brighton railway line, commuter line, which has a Grade 2 listed viaduct, not very far away. It's less than a mile from the reservoir and the River Ouse, both of which are drawn on for drinking water. It's a mile from the village of Balcombe and not that much further from the village of Cookfield. It's 2.5 miles from the Millennium Seed Bank, which is an underground global resource of seeds for the whole planet. This is the technology that causes earthquakes. What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, we've seen in the States some evidence of groundwaters being polluted. Is that something you're worried about in Balcombe?
Extremely concerned about the water contamination. There's been a lot of distraction over the seismic mitigation since the earthquakes. The government admitted it and then said that they've got seismic mitigation practices in place, which is preposterous. They've got this traffic light warning system so that when they start causing earthquakes, it'll stop. Well, that's not going to work, is it? It has distracted from the very real risks of contamination of watercourses, of wild watercourses, of aquifers, of reservoirs. This stuff is messing with subterranean geology. It's messing with fault lines. Methane can migrate along these fault lines. There are a whole cocktail of carcinogens, which they keep saying are no different than the stuff you find under your sink, but the quantities they're going under there, there are carcinogenic volatile organic compounds being injected at high pressure into the subterranean geology. You cannot clean a contaminated aquifer. There's also a radioactive element that is both introduced and released from the subterranean geology. One of the biggest concerns is, where is the waste going to go? There are huge volumes of water that are contaminated that are coming back up, which cannot be disposed of safely. Even the Environment Agency is confused about how to do this. They've already sanctioned dumping Quadrilla's waste to be dumped in the Manchester Ship Canal, supposedly having been treated. There's another company that's currently dumping in the Firth of Forth. In Australia and America, we have evidence of this. We have film, we have proof of this. The toxic radioactive frack waste effluent, which they call produced water, very euphemistically, is being loaded up into tankers and sprayed on roads as either dust suppressant or de-icer.
How do the residents in Balcombe generally feel about the prospect of this happening on their doorstep?
When I first heard about it, I went with a friend and booked the village hall, and we started a Facebook page and put out leaflets, and we had close to 300 people came to a meeting. Quadrilla came as well, asked if they could speak there, and they were metaphorically lynched by 298 of those people. People are absolutely outraged that permission was given for this without any public consultation. In the official poll that was done, 82% of residents opposed it. That doesn't include the employees and tenants of the Balcombe Estate, because it's the Balcombe Estate that has leased the land, and you had to give your postcode to give your opinion, so it may well be a higher percentage.
The government seems to be suggesting, relying on this report from the Royal Society and the Royal Academy of Engineers, that essentially, if it's done right, if it's regulated properly, this industry can be safe and poses no threat to the local environment where it's taking place.
Safe fracking is the oxymoron of the decade, in my understanding, as a layperson who's been researching this for nearly a couple of years now. I've met personally with Jessica Ernst, who is an oil and gas industry scientist of 30 years standing in Alberta in Canada. She is now suing the company that she worked for and the Canadian government, because they have the highest standards of regulations in the world. They fracked her land, they contaminated her water, her skin burned in the bath, her dog snarled and backed away from the water bowl. She has to bring in her water now. She's in a terrible situation. This high-volume, slick-water, horizontal hydraulic fracturing cannot be done safely. It is such a human arrogance for them to say that they can regulate it and control it. You cannot legislate for the vagaries of subterranean geology. When you put this stuff down there at high pressure, involving detonation, with noxious chemicals and radioactivity, it's just not possible by any criterion to guarantee it safe. And then there are all the concomitant effects. There's all the waste, as I've mentioned. There's the air pollution. There's everything else that goes along with it. It's just not possible to regulate it. We cannot settle for anything less than an outright ban.
Can I ask you about your local council's position in all this? Do they actually have any power to oppose these developments?
That's a very good question. The Balcombe Parish Council initially came under some criticism for not tabling the application properly and for passing it through on through County Council. To be fair, Quadrilla's planning application contained the phrase, "there may be a need to stimulate." That is a widely used industry euphemism for fracking. So even if anybody had heard of it 3 years ago here, they wouldn't have known necessarily that's what it was. Since then, there are members of the West Sussex County Council who are opposed. There are some who don't seem to have a problem with it, but it's all a bit of a moot point because the government is now trying to push through the Growth and Infrastructure Bill. As I understand it, I'm not sure about this, about the progress. I think it's through the Commons, but not yet through the Lords. If Osborne and co. succeed in this, it will be taking the powers away from local government, and our local councillors will be powerless.
And there's also a local link, I understand, between your MP, Francis Maud, and Lord Brown, who has interests in fracking. Do you think that's a healthy relationship?
It is a deeply unhealthy, appalling relationship. I've challenged Mr. Maud personally on this, although he initially refused to speak to me because I'm not a constituent. I did eventually get a paper letter from him. He appointed Lord John Brown, who is the ex-chairman of BP and the chairman of Quadrilla, as a lead non-executive sitting on the Cabinet Office board at the heart of government. in June 2010. In July 2010, Quadrilla did a test frack in Cowden in Kent. When I asked Mr. Maud about this and asked him why he hadn't disclosed it to his constituents at his surgery in Borkum, he simply waffled on about what a terribly well-informed and well-connected person he is and how helpful he is, all sorts of nonsense, and said he doesn't receive a salary, so there is no conflict of interest. That is just the most appallingly patronising nonsense I've heard in a long time. How the man can say that a man with fingers in every fossil fuel pie in the country, specifically major stakeholder in Quadrilla, sitting at the heart of government as an advisor, is not a conflict of interest, beggars belief.
Do you think Francis Maud is actually representing Balcombe's interest?
Well, I can just say that Francis Maud has not been to any of the public meetings that we have run.
Right.
I haven't heard of any statements from him. I think the fact that he has appointed Lord Brown to the Cabinet Office says it all, really, and the fact that he has apparently not opposed any of this.
Is it just Balcombe that's targeted for fracking in West Sussex, or are there other potential communities that are also affected?
It is absolutely not just Balcombe. There are potential licences. The PEDL blocks go right across the Kent and Sussex Weald. We've just learned that there are other permissions that have gone through near Billingshurst in West Sussex. Quadrilla, as I said, have done a test in Cowden. We think they've abandoned that. They tried to go for Lingfield in Surrey. IGAS, Magellan, Celtic, there are several other companies. It's the Weald seems to be the second target after the Boland Shale in Lancashire. No, everybody is at risk from this.
So the other interesting development nationally is that there's this idea that some form of financial benefit will accrue to local communities that have fracking on their doorstep. How do you feel about that prospect?
How do I feel about the prospect of being bribed? Because that's what it is. It is blatant. They've only stopped short of using that word. They talk about incentives. Quadrilla's already, I think they paid for a roof on the village hall in one of the towns in Lancashire, one of the villages there. They've sponsored a competition for young scientists in a school. It is so condescending. I don't know why they think that the British people are so credulous that we're really going to fall for this. People can see, well, I hope that people are going to see in time that all the stuff they're saying about jobs and local benefits to the economy are so disingenuous. The employment, the people are brought in, they're specialised workers. They're not there for very long and then they're moved on to other places. A lot of the workers, even if there was employment, the frack field workers in the States are getting silicosis in their lungs. People are dying in explosions, and because of chemical spills, it's not a desirable industry to work for.
Okay. I know you've spent some time recently in Lancashire. What's the situation there?
The situation in Lancashire is pretty dire, although it's on hold because the people have got very busy and have insisted that Quadrilla do an environmental impact assessment, which has set them back. Quadrilla are inept cowboys. They're pathfinders. We mustn't be under any illusions, though, about who are behind them. There's ExxonMobil and Statoil, possibly Shell, although Shell have made a PR statement that they don't want to be involved in UK Shell because they don't want to be in the papers every day because they can see what a hot potato it is. Quadrilla, so far, because that's what we're dealing with, have a 50% failure rate in Lancashire. They've messed up two of their four wells. At one of the wells in Grange Road, a few days ago, I spoke to a couple who live within sight of it, and they said it was like Cape Canaveral, the light pollution, the drilling that they could feel. They had permission to drill, I think, for 8 months, but they kept breaking the drill bits. They had no idea what they were doing. They just kept messing up. They went on for 13 months. They asked to come on the land to do a baseline testing of water, but said they wouldn't disclose the results. So the farmer said no. And then they finally agreed to disclose it, so they did allow them to do it, but how trustworthy that is, we don't know. The thing that struck me most was the man who's lived with this for over a year, although not even fracking, this is just drilling, for over a year on his land. And I introduced myself, and I said, hello, I live 4 miles from where Quadrilla are going to start drilling in Sussex. He took my hand and he said, I'm sorry. And it was as if he was giving me condolences for a bereavement.
Right. That's powerful stuff.
Yeah, it was. It nearly made me cry there and then.
Yeah.
That was Vanessa Vine from Frack Free Sussex. And since that interview, just yesterday in fact, rig equipment has started arriving in Bolcombe, which the community say is before the Environment Agency and Department for Energy and Climate Change have issued permits. Go to the Frack Free Sussex Facebook page to see how you can let the Environment Agency know that there is a significant public interest at stake here. This is not just about Bolcombe, but about the UK's energy future and our right to a hospitable planet. Communities like Bolcombe are getting organised, inspired by the Lock the Gate movement in Australia, and with all other means exhausted, they're getting ready for peaceful blockades. But back to those No Dash for Gas protesters. As the story now goes, 21 went up the chimney, but metaphorically at least, some 64,000 came down when a mass petition was signed in support of their action. With the defeat of the decarbonisation amendment to the Energy Bill in the House of Commons last week, and the imminent threat of gas fracking, the fight against the Dash for Gas and for clean power that helps protect people from high fuel bills and fuel poverty goes on. In August, climate campaigners will be going back to the site of the West Burton Power Station en masse for a four-day action camp called Reclaim Power, where people will be deciding democratically how to win this battle. Check out nodashforgas.org.uk for more details. To end the show, here's No Dash for Gas activist Danny Chivers reciting to his fellow activists a poem he wrote while on top of the 60-foot West Burton gas chimney, which they occupied for 8 days in the freezing wind last October. Thanks for listening. To hear this programme again, and a full list of references, visit climateradio.org.
Can you smell gas? Seeping through the cracks of our energy policy. We're 80 metres high, but we're closer to reality than back-scratching bureaucrats' cheap gas fantasies as the North Sea runs dry. So it's hooray for Norway, hurrah for Qatar, jumping to the pumps to supply a twitching Great Britain with its hot, gassy high. Meanwhile, outside the power station, we hid in vegetation when security guards came by. And despite being about as well hidden as the government's pro-corporate agenda, i.e. not very, we somehow got past and then ran as fast as a Tory MP towards a glass of fine dry sherry. We dashed for the gas, through the fence's massive gap, paired over to the stairs, and there, our mad scramble became even madder as we hauled ourselves up 60 metres of ladder, out of reach of the security, out of reach of doubt and futility. High above the feeling that we can't change anything. Higher than a kite. As high as you like. Almost as high as EDF's latest price hike. And as the gas turbine grinds and winds its way down into silence. In the resulting hush, it dawns on us all that the most powerful thing in this station now is us. But why be so mean and so cruel? Surely gas is the clean fossil fuel. Yeah, natural gas. Natural as an oil slick or a coal pile. Natural as the PR pro's rosy smile. It's nearly as filthy as its fossil fuel friends, but it's just got a bit more style. Shoving its way into a government-loving, sinister ministers huddled round the gas ring, going into raptures over dreams of carbon capture and hot profits from shale that simply can't fail. Don't these fracking people ever learn? Would you like your apocalypse on maximum heat or on more of a slow burn? Meanwhile, outside the fossil-fried corridors of carbon power, when the public are asked, would you like to have gas? The answer this brings is, we'd rather have wind. It's this plain common sense that we brought through the fence and hauled up the ladders and round the stairwell to the peak of the chimney to stand there and yell, hey there, UK! Bloody hell! All our time's nearly gone. Didn't you notice the smell? You left the gas on.